Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon for another of our Sheldrake Vernon dialogues.
Hi there, Rupert. Hi.
Hi, Mark. And we're in these discussions, we talk about things that we're thinking about ourselves, and we bounce ideas off each other. And it's an ongoing series because whenever we meet, we seem to have things we want to discuss. And our hope is that when you listen to these, that you may find them interesting, and it may help to trigger off discussions with your own friends. So it's really trying to spread the spirit of discussion and exploration. So if you like this, do tell your friends about it. So Mark, today I wanted to talk about spiritual evolution.
Right.
Because normally, we think of evolution as biological evolution, technical evolution, evolution of machinery, cultural evolution. But when it comes to spirituality, and indeed religion in general, many people have the idea that that's not evolving, it's sort of located in the past. The great insights of the Upanishads, the enlightenment of the Buddha, the life and example of Jesus, all these things are in the past, and that spirituality involves returning to ancient practices. Well, I think it does, but I think what's going on today is actually an unprecedented phase of spiritual evolution that hasn't happened before. Of course, it's rooted in the past. All evolution is rooted in the past. Scientific evolution is rooted in the past. I mean, everyone who studies science has to learn about Newton and, you know, the history of and Faraday and the concepts of fields and Darwin and evolution. It's rooted in what's gone before. But what we have today, as I show in my book Science and Spiritual Practices, is an extraordinary situation where spiritual practices from almost all the world's traditions are now available to us. 18 million people in America now meditate, whereas 100 years ago, probably almost no one would have meditated in America or in Europe. Many millions of people are doing yoga all over the world. So these things have escaped from their home in India and been spread all over the world on a vast scale. Similarly, the diaspora of Tibetan monks and lamas has meant that Tibetan practices are now practiced all over the world, whereas before they were confined to monasteries and caves in Tibet. And at the same time, religions are undergoing rapid evolutionary development as they come to terms with the modern world and the cultural changes. The most obvious example in Christianity is the growth of Pentecostalism, which began in Los Angeles in its modern form in the early 20th century, where people started speaking in tongues and practicing healing gifts, rooted in the accounts in the New Testament, but taking on a whole new experiential form. And this has now spread all around the world through Pentecostalist churches and the charismatic movement. There are now more than 500 million Pentecostal or charismatic Christians, over a quarter of the entire world population of Christians. Many of them are in countries like the Philippines and Brazil and Africa. They're not so common here in Western Europe. And that's a completely different kind of Christianity, you know, this very experiential, spirit-filled, channeling the spirit type of Christianity. Meanwhile, there's the development of psychedelics and the growth of psychedelic experiences. And some of them involve taking shamanic psychedelics like ayahuasca, with guidance from traditional shamans, but there's now millions of people, or tens of thousands of people, go to Peru and South America. So traditional shamans are no longer traditional in the sense they're dealing with huge numbers of groups of tourists, and there are centres springing up all over Peru where it's legal. It's kind of psychedelic tourism or pilgrimage that people are going on. Meanwhile, there are new psychedelics like LSD that never existed before. So there's all these ranges of experience opening up all over the world, and an enormous curiosity about them. And now scientific studies on many of them, many scientific studies on meditation, on psychedelics, anthropological studies on this Pentecostalist Christianity and so on. So there's this extraordinary exploration of the spiritual realm going on, and most of this is happening outside the framework of traditional religions. Some is happening within them, but basically their traditional structures and rituals haven't prepared them for this extremely rapid change. And in a sense, the American type of free market religion, where anyone can start a new church, in a way that's better adapted to this change, which is why all these Pentecostalist churches have sprung up. So I think there is one issue here is that spiritual evolution not only seems possible, but seems to be happening rapidly at the moment, and we're in at the beginning of a whole new phase of spiritual evolution. Secondly, it's not coordinated, it's just happening in different areas spontaneously, or at least with some organisation. But thirdly, it's not within the established religions, but a lot of it could be brought within their framework, but that would involve religious evolution as well. So I wonder what you think about all that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly see the evolution side on all the things that you mentioned, and maybe also to add in the development of psychology across the 20th century and 21st century. So psychology can be very clinically based, it can be very behaviourally based, but certainly in the psychotherapeutic area, which is where I practice, I think a lot of what goes on in psychotherapy are forms that would previously have gone on in spiritual settings, say in religious houses, you know, the business of coming to see someone, confessing, speaking freely of experiences that you don't know otherwise how to make sense of, talking about things like dreams, trying to become more alert to forces that go through your life, which in psychotherapy is known as the unconscious, but perhaps in a spiritual tradition would be called subtle forces or the etheric body, that kind of thing.
Mm.
I think that that too would be another way in which spirituality has, in a way, developed a kind of quite a sophisticated wisdom too, but that's so wholly outside of traditional religious settings, as you're saying. And in fact, there's often a bit of wariness in from the religion about things like psychotherapy and no doubt about other spiritual manifestations. And I think that that wariness is because people realise there's a kind of tension. Maybe even it feels like a competition at certain times. But as if the more traditional religious systems have slightly lost touch with the spiritual ground of the religion. That's broadly, I suppose, the way I see it. That religions certainly at certain phases in their own evolution, maybe when they've become very, very identified with a civilization, you know, such as Christianity has become very, very identified with Western European civilization, it, as it were, becomes rather this worldly and loses touch with its spiritual roots and its spiritual springs. This is something which has been noted by people like Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, in his, you know, fantastic book, A Secular Age. He talks about how there's been, he calls it, a supernova of experiments with the porous self, the self that can connect and be open to the spirit, and that often traditional religions are left behind in this because they've become very connected to, say, the moral norms of a civilization, which is good in so far as it goes. You know, civilizations need moral norms, but their energies are so directed to propping up the things which sustain a civilization, in terms of morality, in terms of, you know, the rituals of a civilization, that they have lost almost the sense, or certainly the kind of the space for the spiritual upwelling, and hence you get things like the charismatic movement, or I think wisdom traditions developing outside of religion altogether, such as psychotherapy.
Yes.
So it makes a lot of sense.
Yes, very interesting. I mean, the point about psychotherapy is fascinating because, in a way, it does play the role that confessors played in traditional Catholic Christianity, but in with a perhaps greater training and knowledge of the working of the unconscious mind and dreams and that sort of thing. perhaps impoverished, though, in those when it's seen as purely secular. I mean, Freud and some of his followers were extremely hostile to religion. He saw religion and spirituality as a kind of throwback to the infancy of mankind that we ought to grow out of. And so there was a great hostility in part of the psychoanalytic movement and in other psychotherapies to the spiritual dimension. So it seems to me that bringing these things a further step in the evolution would be to take all those insights and link them in. I mean, one thing that we've mentioned before is, would be, say, dream incubation, where in the ancient world, people used to go to temples. King Solomon did it in ancient Greece. They did it at the temples of Aesculapius, at Epidaurus and elsewhere. There were Roman temples in Britain where people went to have dreams, to pray for dreams, the intention of having a healing or an oracular dream. Still happens in the Greek Orthodox Church, in churches of Saints Cosmo and Damian. It still happens in Sufi shrines in India and in Shiva temples in Bengal and elsewhere in India, in Hindu temples. But that would be an area where if people go to a holy place like a church or a special place on a retreat, in a retreat centre, or a monastery. I mean, I think monasteries and the monastic tradition could take on a whole new lease of life because they are, in many of them, about contemplative activity, and they do provide, they've got the buildings and often in great beautiful settings with gardens and things, perfect for spiritual retreats. They already give spiritual retreats. But a dream incubation retreat, sleeping in a church or in a monastery or in a holy place or in sacred groves, or would be something which would bring the spiritual dimension together with these discoveries of psychotherapeutic techniques into a new synthesis.
Yeah, forms of psychotherapy which are thinking about not just who you are but where you are, as I've heard it put, because where you are affects what you can experience, what you sense, as much as who you are in terms of your development or the past. So I think that being open, using places like woods, places certainly outside of the cities, which are tend to be very humanly constructed environments, is something which there's a growing evidence base even now that can be part of helping people out of very particularly forms of mental ill health that are very locked in, such as obsessions or phobias or depression. That finding yourself in a different place with a very different energy, a different vitality, can be quite releasing, in fact.
Mm.
Yeah. One of the things which I wonder about the idea of spiritual evolution that I feel is quite a central issue is the ego. I think that a lot of discussion goes on about the ego, about the sense of self, and is the ego, as it were, the enemy? Does one need to overcome the ego or smash the ego, or what to do about this sort of sense of self? And I don't know how you perceive this, but my sense is this is quite a crucial issue, because one of the things that modern world has given us in psychological evolution, say, is quite a powerful sense of being an individual. This is both good and bad. The bad side is it can make you feel locked in, as if you've got a kind of autonomy, a kind of choice-based freedom to do what you want to do, and it causes clashes and all sorts of things, which can be very soul-destroying. But there's clearly a good side to the modern sense of the self. Individuals who didn't have freedoms before, like, say, women, have a lot of freedoms now, and the valuing of the individual must have played a big part in that, I think. So in terms of our spiritual evolution next, my sense is, and actually this comes from Jung, one of the founders of psychotherapy, who was very open to the spiritual, obviously, but Jung made this remark that I think goes a long, long way, actually, that the ego makes a very good servant but a terrible master. And I feel that in that notion, in a way, is a whole stage of evolution. How one can shift in oneself from the sense of self, that rather than, as it were, ploughing through life, setting goals, having purposes, wanting things, driving, as it were, a world that's of your own making, very ego-centred, you might say, to a sense of the ego that can tune in, discern, build, imagine, intuit, in the service of a kind of greater spirituality.
Hmm.
You know, that's quite a struggle for an individual. I mean, it's the work of a lifetime for an individual.
Hmm.
I wonder about, at a more collective or social level too, what's happening to the ego, whether there are, you know, collective experiences that too are reorientating one of the great gains of the modern world, the sense of being an individual.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because part of the spiritual evolution does involve collective activities. I mean, raves, for example, and ecstatic dancing, particularly fueled by things like ecstasy, MDMA, are a relatively new phenomenon, certainly for the West. I mean, tribal dances, people going into trances and dancing together into altered states of consciousness. But for our society, where it's not what people were used to doing, I mean, it's very different from ballroom dancing, which are minuets and things, or even barn dances, and which are real fun collective dances, but this is something else. And the growth of festivals and the fact that people go to festivals and raves and dance ecstatically is a kind of an ego dissolution, I suppose, because you're no longer such a separate individual if you're part of a collective celebration. That's one way in which I think people try and counteract the excessive isolation of the ego.
Yeah.
And it follows some, in many cultures, it's a traditional way to do it. I mean, singing together is another way. So partly one way of dealing with the ego is to have collective activities where you come together with other people, and those have always happened in all religions, but they also happen today in these secular forms.
Yes, yeah, I can see that. And I also wonder whether there needs to be a kind of an inner development, which in a way is about trusting inner life, so that the experiences which become very intense and joyful, as well as perhaps frightening at times as well, through using psychedelics or in raves, you're also able to tune in and sort of self-amplify the subtle movements of inner life, the subtle sort of ups and downs of feeling. I mean, this is partly what you do in psychotherapy.
Mm.
Encourage people to take the undulations of inner life more seriously, and they discover that they're actually very revealing. But more generally, I think there's got to be a movement from seeing authority somehow external to oneself, you know, maybe in science and empirical discovery, maybe in religious authority and traditions based on rituals or creeds or texts, to seeing that that external authority is really a kind of shadow of the felt authority that can be known inside, that is at the same time much more resilient but also more flexible, because it's something that that can cope with things like paradox, that can cope with things being both and, you know, not either or, that can cope with being on the edge of knowing and not knowing, you know, which is the goal of the mystic. And I think that, you know, this is important because then you're on the edge of you're at a kind of threshold, and the ego, you know, which I was just mentioning a few minutes ago, finds itself on the edge of a threshold, and wanting to step over that into something that's more than just itself, but nonetheless is somehow held within the self. I mean, I think this is the heart of the Christian idea of incarnation, actually, which is an old idea, of course, but perhaps gets a bit lost in the modern world, where Jesus is seen much more as someone who had to, as it were, come in from the outside to save us, a much more external notion of authority. Whereas for me, the heart of Christianity actually is the incarnation, where the historical incarnation of Jesus, who is both human and divine, is actually a footnote to the calling to all of us to wake up to our inner divinity, That's really what the incarnation is about. Meister Eckhart said this, you know, it's not a new idea. It's sort of standard mystical theology, actually.
Well, in the Greek Orthodox Church, it's pretty standard theology, full stop. I mean, theosis, becoming God, or this deification process, is actually the basis of their main theology.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe for the West, I completely agree with that, and maybe for the West, recovering, or maybe it got, I don't know, maybe it got, things went a bit off-centre with the Reformation, you know, where very different ideas about what Christianity might be about, and this wisdom, spiritual wisdom that was held in religious houses sort of got taken out in about 10 years. I think you can never underestimate the impact of that. I was reading recently that in the 14th century, there were more monasteries and religious houses in Britain than there were villages and towns. You know, the monasteries and religious houses numbered, you know, say 1,000, and the number of towns and so on numbered a few hundred. It's really very dramatic, that sort of cutting away of that side of life.
Yes. Well, I mean, what happened there was that there were the people who specialised in various forms of spiritual pursuit in these monasteries. And the same happened in Tibet, of course, where a considerable proportion of the population were in monasteries or convents. But the purpose of the Reformation was to say that these spiritual pursuits should not be confined to a specialist minority. They should be for everyone. And in a sense, what we're talking about, what you're particularly mentioning about how each person has to discover within themselves this source of authority, that is, as it were, a fruit of the Reformation.
Yeah, I completely accept that. The idea that one might have a personal relationship with God, as it's sometimes put, is definitely a product of the Reformation. And I can also understand how a lot of religious people are wary of that, because you wonder what on earth people are going to discover with this inner authority, and no doubt there are plenty of examples where it goes wrong.
Where they get lost or get terrible ego inflation and so on, yes.
Yeah, so it needs a whole infrastructure of spiritual direction and guides and a sort of rediscovery of wisdom and so on as well. And an alertness to things like pride, as you say, and ego inflation and all that as well. But I'm sure that, well, I don't know if I'm sure, but maybe this is another unfolding of the Reformation. That there was a kind of intensification of the individual at that time.
Mm.
And now we're into another stage, as you're intimating.
Well, it'd be interesting to know, it'd be a sociological investigation, but is this kind of evolution that we've been discussing, you know, through psychedelics, through meditation, through yoga, etc., something that's happening more intensely in traditional Protestant countries, where individuals have been more empowered by this Protestant Reformation? And it may be less common in, say, Islamic countries or Catholic or Orthodox countries, where there's been a much stronger emphasis both on authority but also on communal activity. You know, in mosques you pray together, Sufi groups go, they dance together, they'd have their ceremonies together. They're not so much individual. So there's a collectivity in this. You know, Catholic countries, they have fiestas or festivals or joint celebrations, communal celebrations, you know, tables in the streets for the feast days and that kind of thing. It's much more communal. And it's possible that spiritual evolution in Catholic and Orthodox and Islamic contexts will be rather different from in Protestant, historically Protestant context.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to know that now. Certainly about, say in the mid part of the 20th century, Jung, who lived in Switzerland, you know, a country which is on the edge of the Protestant world and the Catholic world. If you go south, you're into the Catholic world. If you go north, you're into the Protestant world. He often remarked that nearly all his patients were Protestants, people who came to him because things had become too troubling. And he wondered whether it was because in Catholic countries, the myths and symbols were still alive through which people could find their own way, rather than in the Protestant world, which all these things were declared sort of anathema. And this left a kind of paucity in relation to inner life. So psychotherapy gets going in Northern Europe.
Yes.
But another 50 or more years on, it'd be very interesting to know how things have changed again.
Yes. Well, I think obviously one of the challenges is to find a way in which these all the spiritual exploration can be done with sort of guides, and it requires some kind of structure or framework, because otherwise if people just go off randomly on their own, or if anyone can set up as a guru or a shamanic practitioner, I now do a 3-week course online to become an ayahuascaero, someone who can lead shamanic groups taking ayahuasca. Well, I'm sure most people who are leading them are competent and experienced, but at the moment there's nothing to stop anyone putting themselves forward and starting guru cults, which, as we know, can go horribly wrong. There have been so many examples.
Yeah, certainly I found in London that finding a spiritual director was a really important thing, someone I meet with about every 8 weeks. Mm. And we discuss whatever comes up, but he has had a substantial training. There's a centre here in London, the London Centre for Spirituality, that trains people in spiritual direction, and I know that there are other similar organisations like that around and about, and they're alert to the involvement of the body, and they've read in the wisdom traditions, both of Christianity and elsewhere. Mm. They've done a bit of psychology formation themselves through groups and so on.
Mm.
So at the moment, I think it's not actually that difficult to find a spiritual director, because whilst there's loads of experimentation going on, I think the idea that you might try and find a guide is still relatively low down a lot of people's agenda. You know,
well, they may not know it's possible.
They may not even know it's possible, exactly. Yeah, mm. But I suspect that going forward, there might well be quite a substantial growth in spiritual direction.
Yes. Well, I think it's one of the most exciting things in the whole modern world, this spiritual evolution, this phase of spiritual evolution that's unfolding at the moment. I mean, it's one reason I wrote the book, Science and Spiritual Practices. But the more I think about it, the more it seems to me that this is the best way forward. I mean, it's hard to think of other ways forward for me. I mean, more technology, more stuff, quicker, more apps on smartphones. That, I mean, that's all happening, but it doesn't seem terribly exciting as the way to go.
Yeah, and also, so this is a point which you make, is that the funny thing is that these technological developments and scientific developments seem to overflow. We seem to be in a phase where they're overflowing into sort of pseudo-spiritual forms, you know, whether it be the technologists that think we're about to reach a kind of omega point, which will be some great new releasing, or in the movie you find, I think, increasingly amongst materialists who have a sense of panpsychism, that the sense that the consciousness must be more than just what's going on in the brain.
Yes.
That the spirituality seems to be sort of returning.
I think it is. As the sort of threadbare quality of the mechanistic materialist worldview becomes increasingly clear, people have got to go somewhere else, and that means, that can only mean really a rediscovery of the spiritual dimension and of the life of nature and of the sense that we're part connected to something much greater than ourselves.
Yeah, well, I hope our conversations play a small part in that too.
I hope so. Thank you.
Cheers.